Are we live now?
I'm recording.
You're listening to Mumbrella Cast.
Mumbrella Cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me to break down your week in media and marketing is Mumbrella's editor, Vivian Kelly.
Hello.
And today we're also joined by TV Black Box editor, Rob McKnight.
I know, I feel like I'm cheating on my podcast by being here, but I'm a big fan of the Mumbrella podcast, so I'm sort of a little bit thrilled.
It's the first crossover episode.
I love it. That's it what is. It should be, right?
It's a crossover. We're just waiting for our invitation back, Rob.
Yes, it's in the mail.
Excellent. Well, we are recording this from the Swiss Hotel in Sydney, where we're currently holding Mumbrella's B2B Marketing Summit, so please excuse any background noise, although as we have locked the door, it'll only be people hammering to try to be allowed in.
Yeah, we're like in a big security fortress here. The doors have been locked. We can't get out. How long are you keeping us for here, Tim?
Well, it all depends on how interesting the next 40 minutes or so are. This week, we'll be talking about
Rove fails to bring back Saturday Night.
Seven puts its faith in pooches.
Fairfax journos turn on their new CEO.
Should the media industry be worried about redundancies?
And 1-3 Cabs is the official partner of Booty Calls.
So, before we get into the week's topics, let's introduce you to Rob McKnight. Now, this morning I was chatting to Viv, or possibly a couple of hours ago. Viv said, "What sort of person is Rob?"
You know. Oh God, what a loaded question!
Well, my answer was TV nerd.
Yes,
and the first time I remember you crossing my radar was you were still at Nine. You were a promo producer, but you were experimenting with I think you called it internet streaming at the time.
Yes, that's right.
And you did, and I remember going on and being a pundit. I can't remember what I talked about, but you were using Nine's facilities to do something really quite early and quite experimental, sort of talking about, you know, the, it seems quite a sort of, you know, everyday thing now, but, you know, sort of streaming a kind of effectively a panel show.
Yeah, it was called Nine Stream Live, and I was really proud of that
snappy
little show.
Snappy name.
Hashtag Nine Stream Live, actually. And we were doing this little show from the automated studio. It took no resources to do it except the time and effort I put in. And we actually developed a following, so much so that when Studio 10 went to Adelaide, I was in the control room, or the makeshift control room, and the floor manager came out and said, "Rob, there's some people out here who want to meet you." And I'm like, "What?" And I walked out, they were all Nine Stream Live fans, and they'd come to Studio 10's recording to have a chat, basically.
Well, I remember Nine Stream Live because, it came across clearly you were really passionate and interested about the making of television.
Yes.
I remember you did one where I think you were able to cross to the Nine Chopper and all that sort of thing.
In one of them, I crossed to London and did an interview with Pete Stefanovic on location outside. One of the royals was having a baby. It could have been Mary, or I can't remember. And it was an actual satellite cross. It wasn't even a Dejero. And I was thinking, they're letting me spend all this money. This is awesome. But it was a great experiment. And it was sort of the genesis for Studio 10 as well, because it was that panel discussion crossing here and there. And so when Adam Boland asked me to go and do Studio 10, there were ideas I took from all of that I build some new ones in, of course, as you make a show bigger. But there's certainly some genesis of Studio 10 from Nine Stream Live.
Well, presumably it put you on the map, really, for the sort of TV production community, because Adam Boland had been sort of the head of morning television at Seven, was brought over Seven to launch a breakfast offer and a mid-morning offering, and which was Studio 10, which was your baby.
It was my baby. He sort of created an outline, and then it was up to me to really put fill in the detail, basically, and make it work and evolve the show. And if you look at episode one to the episode when I left, they are very different shows, actually, because it wasn't a revolution, it was an evolution over time. We started seeing what didn't work and what worked, and I just kept nudging all the time and evolving and seeing what worked as far as audience flow. And that's why 9:30 became a big turn on point, and we would tailor segments to the 9:30 slot. And so it was great. When I left, it was doing 100,000 viewers a day, which is awesome.
And Rob, how high pressure is it working in an environment like that? I'm not sure if you're aware, but Zoe, who's sitting next to you pushing our buttons on the podcast, was an intern at Studio 10 at one point, and we asked her what it was like, and she said you had a bit of a reputation for being, and I quote, terrifying.
Yeah, well, Zoe's sitting right next to me. I'm going to bring her in here. Zoe, was I terrifying?
Not for me.
Zoe, you look
she's pulling back now.
Zoe, you look terrified.
Oh, well, funny that
Tim, I have been thrown under the bus and all. No, I mean, I did work on the 1,000th episode.
Oh, that was a big episode.
It was a big episode, and I recall them not ordering enough food for all of the media staff who were there to watch the 1,000th episode. And so myself and another intern were sent to run to IGA to buy more food.
That's a true story. And, you know, the thing is, there are times when you give instructions like you've got to understand that this is this 1,000th episode I was treating like a primetime special. And even though it was a little morning show on the number three network, this was our big primetime special. We were celebrating something that everyone thought was impossible. No one expected us to get to 100 episodes, let alone 1,000.
Well, I remember, I think one time I heard from you very early on, and I only know this because I was going back through old emails because I knew you were chatting.
Is this going to be about when you wrote about us getting zero in Perth?
Yeah, zero in Perth, that's right. Yes, wow, you do remember. Oh, yes. Yeah. That was that on day one that you for a 15-minute segment?
Yes.
And of course, it was one of those things because all of the rival networks, of course, look for bad news about a rival. So we'll pull out data like that and then share it with the trade press. So somebody pointed out that thing. So I the thing was, I couldn't find an angry email. So it must have been a phone call. I can't remember which, but I do remember crossing your radar and the fact that we'd reported this number.
I don't know that I often wrote angry emails or I never abused journalists or anything like that. And I think that's why when I left 10, I actually had a good relationship with the journalistic community because I wasn't like that. I might get annoyed at an article or something, but usually I found that if you treated people with respect, they gave it back to you. And that's what I found.
Passionate, I think, is the
Yeah, definitely passionate. Definitely would have been times. And look, going on about the food being lost and me demanding that everyone go to IGA and get more food, that's actually pretty tame, to be honest.
I was like, come on, Zoe. The IGA is like 200 metres down the street. Is it that
hard? Have you been there?
Do you know, I actually have been in the IGA near the Channel 10 studios. I can't remember why, but I have been in there.
In Zoe's defence, she didn't say she thought you were terrifying. Right. That was the general perception on the floor that perhaps you could be terrifying.
You know what? Because I was passionate, and if you weren't listening, like the food situation, I'd been very clear in that we needed food, this is an event, the tables need to be sorted. And then you turn up on the day and there's like two chips to rub together for, you know, people. It's just not good enough, right? And so I had high expectations. To me, the thing you had to do when you were running that show was you had to give the audience a reason for coming every minute because we were the challenger brand. And so you really had to make sure that if someone flicked over because 9 and 7 were the defaults. They had the lead-ins from the breakfast shows. So if they came to us, we couldn't be serving up crap. We had to be delivering something special each and every time. And so when we workshop these ideas, if they were half-assed, I would get upset about that because it was putting everyone's job on the line. I always felt Studio 10 was never a safe show because it was always on the chopping block. And so I felt we had to prove every day that we deserved to be there by getting an audience and driving revenue.
I think one of my favourite TV moments of all time, and I remember watching it live, we all watched it live in the office, the day you had the crossover of Ita on a boat with Sam Mack, and you were on the water taxi. I guess it was probably from Manly because it was probably crossing over from Wake Up. And at first I thought it looked like a stunt as everything went wrong.
Yes.
But did it break down?
Yes, it did. So what had happened is that it was when I had taken over when Bolo had gotten sick and I had to take over both shows, and that's a book in itself. But they wanted Ita because Studio 10 was outperforming Wake Up, which is not what should happen. The morning show should not outrate the breakfast show. So we thought, well, Ita's the draw card. We'll get her on as their guest tweeter of the day. They had a segment I'm struggling to remember. And I said, okay, we'll do that. And what we'll do is we'll turn it into an event where we're getting Ita back to Studio 10. And so the water taxi seemed like, okay, that's going to be 20 minutes of fun and then she'll come in. And, of course, it really did break down. And everyone's like this. First of all, there was one point where Sam Mack nearly lost Ita over the side of the boat as she was getting onto the water taxi. We all thought the taxi started coming away from the pier and we all thought, oh, she's going to fall in. And then she gets into the boat. They're traveling along. And we keep doing crosses and it breaks down. And there is a shot of Ita sitting in the back of the boat getting very sick because it wasn't moving, it was moving and all
it
was, about.
Wasn't it beyond the heads at this point? Yes. So it was pretty choppy.
Yeah, it was choppy. And anyway, they ended up getting the boat towed to an area where the head of production went and picked her up and drove her to the studio, and it was right near the end, so it had been going on. I could not have planned this any better. She still thinks to this day I did plan it, like you. I turned up and gave her a bottle of champagne, and this wasn't on audio, but you can see me saying this to her. I went into her ear and I said, "Ita, I'm sorry, but this was such good television."
In that moment when you thought she might fall into the water, were you panicked or were you thinking, this would be great television?
There's lots of things I want to do, but I don't want to be the one who kills Ita Buttrow. So, no, I Ita and I were at the very beginning of our relationship, yeah. And I consider Ita a very dear friend now. And, no, I wouldn't have wanted to kill Ita Buttrow, so I can tell you that.
And, hey, just talking of Sam Mack, I mean, obviously he's really made his name now over at Seven as their weather guy. I know he was more associated with Wake Up, but great talent.
Great talent. And he did a lot on Studio 10 as well, and we often had him after that doing a lot of things with Ita. He was very, very talented. And I even the idea that he was up for the Gold Logie, I love that because he also loves the medium. And so you can see that with the kind of stuff he does. It's not half-assed. He's giving to each and every cross. He's thinking them through. What can I do? How can I make this a bit more compelling? And I think he deserves everything he's getting.
Now, we should talk about TV Black Box, which is your next project post Leaving 10, and we will touch on Leaving 10 as well. Mm-hmm. I love the intro when you listen to the – it's a website, but it's also a podcaster, a washed-up producer with nothing to lose.
Yeah, that's the McKnight Tonight theme. And I just – when it all happened – and I started the idea of doing podcasting. I just thought,
well, tell you what, let's go to where it all happened first, shall we? Yeah, let's do it in logical order. So, you know, Studio 10 seemed to be, for the outside, seemed to be going incredibly well.
And it was.
You know, it was pretty much, I think, 10's only daytime hit.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it blew up and you were out. And from the outside, it looked a bit weird.
Yeah, look, there's a lot I can't talk about because of the settlement.
I thought you had nothing to lose, Rob.
Well, legal. Well, let me tell you something that I have been through the ringer with 10's legal department. But hey, 10 and I are all good friends now, and I'm glad about that. We've all gone through the hardship of the breakup, you know, and it was a bit of breakup, you know. I would argue there were politics involved and not being liked by the right people, and you know what, that happens in TV. So. Anyway, yes, and then we had the Brussels sprouts incident and, you know, all the shenanigans.
The Brussels sprouts incident. So what's been reported, I think, was that at the Christmas, the cast Christmas party.
No, it was a Christmas shoot. It was, right. We were shooting a video clip.
Right.
So it wasn't a party, so there shouldn't have been drinking, and there was drinking.
Right, okay.
And, yes, Denise has admitted this on the record.
This is Denise Drysdale?
Mm-hmm.
Through a Brussels sprout.
Not one.
Okay.
Lots.
A number of Brussels sprouts, which hit Ita.
Hit Ita, and they were cooked, buttered Brussels sprouts.
Right.
And I actually have the footage of that. but, yeah, and they left a big stain on Ita, and Ita is a trooper, she keeps going on, but it was very unprofessional, shouldn't have happened. There was a divide within Studio 10, and I think that became obvious between where the presenters sat. But when I was asked, I think the biggest mistake they made was they turned their back on what was making Studio 10 work, and there were a bit of politics involved in that, because there had been some ideas of changing the show, and I was resistant to those ideas. I figured, I'm getting $100,000 a day. I built the show up. I understand this show, and what you're wanting us to do is go back to a carbon copy of the other ones, you know. And so that's what they started doing when I left. And I've never seen ratings dissipate so quickly. Usually the rule in television is when you make changes, there's usually a 6-month lag between when you see the positive or negative effects of that, because it takes the audience time to realize. Within a month, Studio 10 had pretty much dropped a third of its audience and is now sitting still to this day at half its audience. It's doing about 47,000-50,000 viewers. And I've got to say, I would actually like to see it go on now, because I invested so much of my time and effort into that show. And look, you know, you look in hindsight and say, did I do everything perfect? Maybe I was terrifying because I was so passionate about it. And, you know, you self-reflect when you've been through the ringer of something so public, you know. People leave jobs or get fired all the time, and it's not in the paper, it's not on websites, and I had to live that. And it really did have an effect, which is ultimately why I've taken the year off in the Gold Coast. It's given me time to breathe and realise there are other things. And doing TV Black Box allows me to still have my passion about television, because I am still passionate about it. But the people who took over from me showed that they didn't understand the show. But they have a new executive producer in Tara Siminanu. I can't say her last name, sorry. I've never met her. That's why I don't know her that well. And she seems to be getting the confidence of the show back up. She is doing her own thing. But the biggest problem is she's inherited a show that was broken, not when it was at its prime. So, and because she was overseas, she hasn't seen why it connected with the audience. And but having said that, she's got to do her own thing. And I, after all the heart, sweat and tears I put into that show, I would love to see it go on for another 20 years, because I would feel some part of the success of that, that it got that far. Because getting through the first year, I think, was one of the greatest challenges of Studio 10.
Well, let's talk TV Black Box. Do you, I suppose I think of you as a product for people within the industry as opposed to consumer TV fans. Is that how you think of it?
I think it is, and we have a very big media following, although we are transcending that now. The podcast is probably still very much a media podcast, but the website is getting great numbers for what I think what are great numbers for a early podcast. We're still only 7 months in, and you'll know if this is a good number or not, but we got a Google thing that said we had 5.6 million impressions in the last month. And I sort of figured that sounds pretty good.
Fifth, that sounds like a good number, doesn't it?
That does sound like a good number. It's got me a bit rattled, Rob, coming for my job. I didn't realise this was a job interview to replace me.
but not all impressions equate to clicks and all that kind of stuff, so I fully understand that. But we have been on a steady growth, and I think we're building a following based on the fact we get exclusives because we've been sitting outside of the publicity-fed machine.
And there are a few of you working together on it as well, aren't
yes,
there?
Yes, we've got Steve Malkin, Kevin Perry, and we've got Aaron Ryan in Perth who contributes as well. And we get guest contributors as well. And it's a little bit of a mishmash at the moment. It's certainly not a well-oiled machine like Mumbrella, where, you know, you have your full team working full-time on it. We're all doing it outside of other things. But what we're not doing is just waiting for a press release, and I'm not saying everyone else does that either, but because of the contacts I've got, when I'm getting fed bullshit by the networks, I know when they're feeding me BS, sorry, I shouldn't swear. And so I know when to go around that, you know, and I wear my heart on my sleeve, and I think that's probably the biggest criticism anyone could have about me, is that I really am passionate. And I've been self-reflecting on this. This is why I can talk about it in the third person in a way. But I do annoy people because I push and I strive. And there's part of me that goes, well, shouldn't we all be pushing and striving for the best product we can possibly give? But then you've also got to realize the reality of people's lives. And I almost killed myself for that job, which is why I was a bit bitter the way 10 did everything. You know, I thought there could have been a better way to do it. But we've made amends and we've moved on, and good luck to everyone. But I probably expected the same amount of passion that I had for Studio 10 from my team and everyone else around me. And there was that, don't get me wrong, there was, but not everyone was drinking the Kool-Aid, or as I've now known from my true crime podcast, it's actually Flavorade.
Now, would you ever go into a TV network job again, or are you done on that now?
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest. I'm certainly not rushing to get any kind of job. It would have to be the right job. And I really actually am enjoying life on the Gold Coast. It's given me perspective, which is a very strange thing. And the reason TV Black Box came about was because I was working at News Corp, and I missed that television thing. And to be honest, News Corp was great, but it wasn't the right job for me, because it wasn't that creative television type of role. And so it sort of led to me getting into a very dark place, and I just needed to get out of that. And thankfully, I had the support of my family. We moved to the Gold Coast. We've restarted our lives, and it really has been like a restart. My youngest child, if I went away for a week, she'd just say, bye, Dad. Now I've come down here for a couple of days, and she's got her arms around me. She's tearing up. She's crying. You know, I'm trying to drop her off at school, and she said, don't go, don't go. You know,
Is this good or bad? I'm trying to
No, it's good. He's saying that his children are used to having him around more.
Yes.
So it's more of a, it's more traumatic and shocking when he disappears to come on the Mumbrella car.
That's right. I've built up a relationship.
I'm sorry that we've traumatized your children by having you here today.
No. It's a good thing. And I say that as a way of saying my relationship with my family has changed. And I think when you get so invested in what you're doing from a work perspective and you lose sight of the personal, you've lost that balance. And there always has to be a balance because we're all trying to make money and we're all trying to have careers, but you have to make sure you're doing it in a smarter way. If I was to go on EP Studio 10 right now, I would be a different executive producer than what I was when I was doing the job. And I think I could still get the same results. I could still have the same vibrant show, but I would be managing it in a different way. There's been a lot of self-reflection since coming off that, and I think that's a life lesson that I will take away with me forever.
Well, next, Rove flops again.
Do we have any time for that?
Yeah, we've got heaps of time.
So, after just 2 weeks, Saturday Night Rove, or Bring Back Saturday Night, as it was originally called, has been cancelled with 10 and Rove McManus reportedly agreeing that the audiences just weren't there in a cosy, collaborative conversation between both parties. Now, the first
sounds very lovely.
It does sound very lovely. Now, that first week, 244,000 Metro viewers, of which I know that Viv was one and I was one because we were texting back and forth during that first episode.
I was one.
So was Rob as well. And then by the second week, 138,000.
I was not one of them for the second episode. I didn't last into week two.
No, me neither. So Rove spoke to our media reporter, Hannah Blackiston, at the time before launch and seemed pretty confident that the audiences were hungry for something to watch on a Saturday night other than sport or BBC Murder Mystery Returns. Rob, where did it all go wrong?
It was a shit show.
End of conversation.
The problem was, and I really, I agree with Rove. I think there is an appetite for variety television back on Australia. We have done the variety so well in this country.
You said on your podcast that you did a pilot yourself when you were at Studio 10.
Yes, it was called Saturday Night from Studio 10. It was a podcast that Peter Meakin helped me push through to give us the opportunity to do it. And it was really well received by everyone. Everyone said, yeah, that feels like a variety show.
I'm thinking Joe Hildebrand in a shiny silver jacket.
Not quite, but it did have, it had Joe, Sarah, Denise and Jessica Rowe. And we did things.
Well, no, Jono Coleman. Surely he's there. Got to be spinning a wheel.
Jono was there, of course. Jono was doing voiceovers. That's what Jono was doing. He was doing the voiceovers, the Judith Lucy or the John Blackman role. And we had segments like Jessica Rowe overcoming her fear of snakes. So she has a genuine fear of snakes. We went and got her training of dealing with snakes and then brought a python onto the set for her to show that she had overcome her fear of snakes live in front of the studio audience. So it was real variety. It was that kind of variety. We reunited viewers. We had someone in the audience who we plucked out and we said, now we've got your mum. You haven't seen your mum or your sister. Sorry. You haven't seen your sister in 20 years. She lives in New Zealand, but we've arranged a live cross to you. To her. And so we did the live cross and we said, oh, how great is it? And she's crying and it's so great to see. And we said, well, guess what? She's actually here in the building. And so we brought her out from the little room she was in, brought her in for the big reuniting. And so it was variety and it was that true essence of variety. I think what we're serving up is too edgy. It's not knowing its audience. And if you look, it's a 7:30 time slot. And some of the jokes, we had masturbation jokes. We had lots of swearing. And I just didn't think, what audience are you going for here? You know, and I don't think the show knew what it was. I think Rove, I actually think Rove is very funny. He's got an audience and that's why you saw so many, not so many people, but a chunk of people go to him on a Saturday night. But the cast beside him weren't great either.
It was a bizarre dynamic for me because I think Justin Hamilton's a really funny comedian, but he was sort of relegated to weirdly sitting at a back table, which wasn't explained, monitoring the live eBay auction that they had going on. I don't think they were using his comedic talents enough, his timing enough, his wit enough. He was just sort of there without context, without a role, and to have such a big supporting team that didn't really make sense to a consumer was really bizarre to me, because Rove's old shows were so good at using other comedians, and Hamish and Andy had such a platform on Rove Live, and so did other up-and-coming comedians. It was weird to have someone as talented and TV-friendly as Justin relegated to a back corner with a beer.
I know.
Well, you were a bit of an expert on Rove in his radio, his short radio career as well, which he obviously was thrown together with Sam Frost from The Bachelor and Bachelorette.
Chemistry test, people. Yes. Chemistry test.
Look, he was one of the many, many people who tried to take over on Today FM Breakfast after Kyle and Jackie O left to Kiss FM. And Rob's right. It's a chemistry thing. I was such a fan of Rove back in the day, in his Rove Live heyday. He didn't work on radio with Sam Frost, but she didn't. I've been speaking to Jules Lund recently, who was another failed Today FM Breakfast host, and he said, you know, Sam could have been great talent, Sam Frost. Australia loved her when she was heartbroken after The Bachelor. She had good stories to tell, but they just didn't train her enough to put her in front of the media.
You can't throw her into a situation like that and expect an untrained person to be a media professional. And that's a huge gig, having to give yourself over 5 days a week.
At 6 o'clock in the morning as well, to be on at that time. So I think Rob's right. Rove has a place, but this show wasn't it. And Judith Lucy, again, very divisive character in that, you know, she's a female over 50 and therefore divisive. But also her jokes didn't work at 7:30 on a Saturday. That's too much.
That comes back to the family stuff. But she got some praise about what she was delivering as far as the show. But it was obviously a show in turmoil behind the scenes too, because the set designer was fired the week before it launched because the set looked too much like Hey, Hey, It's Saturday. And the problem was the person delivered like 14 designs, of which they picked the one they wanted. They built it and then they went, too much, Hey, Hey, say it, get someone else. And so when you're not decisive on what the show is, that's a problem. And when you don't understand what you're trying to deliver to the audience.
Surely they had time though, because this first premiered in TEN's pilot week last year. That's when it should have been ironing out its kinks. That's the whole point of pilot week. And that's when it was called Bring Back Saturday Night. They had months to workshop this, get feedback from consumers. That's what a pilot is. That's the whole premise of it. And then they brought it back for its alleged 6-episode run. And it felt like the pilot, but we've already done that.
The pilot was better. I think the pilot was better than what they actually broadcast, which either says maybe too many people meddled in the actual series.
Will Rove have a future on television or radio again, do you think?
I think Rove is a bit like Grant Denyer. Yes, he will. You know, some people think that Rove and Grant are TV poison and ratings poison. They're not my words. They're the words of astute Mumbrella commenters and observers. But they do continue to get gigs and get opportunities. And it's worth noting as well, while we're slamming Rove, that behind the scenes he's had success with Roving Enterprises and with
he's got the money coming in. You don't need to worry about that. He does not need our thoughts and prayers. He's doing all right.
But so he does have good relationships, and I think this will be a blow for him, but I reckon, we'll see him again in some way.
Well, next, more programming announcements. 7 partners with Rebel Wilson on Pooch Perfect. So, shortly after signing a contract, you heard that sigh, to host Amazon's new comedy program, LOL, Last One Laughing, Aussie actor Rebel Wilson has signed on to host 7's latest foray into competitive reality television, Pooch Perfect. I think this is James Warburton's, I know he wouldn't have made the, you know, thought it up and come in and said, guys, I've got a great idea, let's announce this straight away. But effectively, it's become his first commission.
Look, and it's interesting timing for James Warburton, the new CEO of 7, because he spoke to me 5 days into his appointment when they released their financial results to the ASX. And he admitted that 7 skews too old and has aging war horses in its programming, and it needs to get that younger demographic back. It needs to get back to Heartland Australia, whoever that is, and connect audiences with the type of content that they believe 7 can produce. Pooch Perfect, I don't know if it fits that bill. it wouldn't be James's responsibility, but it's worth noting Seven already has a dog program, dogs behaving in brackets, very close brackets, badly. That in prime time got 484,000 Metro viewers
this
week.
I'm thinking it was probably quite cheap to make, though.
It probably was, but, you know, it's getting smashed by The Block on Nine, smashed by Australian Survivor
on
10. But
it's a clip show from existing material. The thing I would say about this, it's not James's first commission because, if I can put this plug in, TV Black Box broke this story a month or so ago that it was called Australia's Top Dog Groomer. Was coming, and we got that story out, and then they were casting for it. So it's been around for a little while. It's unfortunate that this is I hadn't thought about it this way, that it's James's first public commission. But the fact is, you've got to accept that from his point of view, while he's in there re-energizing the team, and that's what I'm hearing, that the people at Seven have been re-energized by him coming in, and there is a new excitement about getting back in there and giving things a go and spending money on quality programming. So I don't think we're seeing the full benefit of what James is going to bring to Channel 7. But this show, if you look at some of the shows 7 have had when it's been Cats Make You Laugh Out Loud, and these things have actually done really well. And with Rebel Wilson, who I'm sure was not inexpensive, to come on to this show, that's a name that might just get people to take a look. And apparently the transformations of the dogs, it's not just doing a bit of frizz. Apparently it's full-on transformation. So there might be a bit of people just wanting to see the train wreck. I don't know. But this is actually one that I think could do okay. I mean, when I saw the proposal, I thought, crap, you know, and the viewers thought the same. But this one actually could be something. And Seven have pulled a couple of those out throughout the years, you know, when they've needed those hits, because it's going to be a tough back half. We know that they've already moved Beverly's Between Two Worlds to 2020 because they want to give it the best possible chance to survive. The question is, how far will they go in the back half of 2019 to try and regain number one and stay in number one position? Do they take the hit and put some shows on that maybe aren't ball terrors, but will actually get them, get them along the way? They've got very strong news and current affairs and sport, but will they have the programming for the back half of 2019, or do they go strong with 2020 and try to make that the story? Because James isn't going to be judged on 2019.
Now, I've just trying to work out the timeline. So when you joined 10, James would have already been fired, is that right?
Yes, he was gone.
So you've never actually worked directly with him?
James may not remember me, but I did have some dealings with him when we set up the morning show.
At Seven.
At Seven, yes, because I was specifically in charge of the editorials, and it was his sales team that were doing it. And I always found him to be an amazing man, and I'm actually glad to see him in this role. I think that it was a tough gig at 10, and, you know, where he basically had to go in and it was all cost-cutting and not real programming. And by the sounds of things, when he's coming to Seven, he said, we're not cutting costs, we're spending money. And I think that's a deliberate thing, learning part from him of what he's gone through at 10.
Yeah, he has said that they can't cost cut their way to success, and he has said he's going to be putting money behind programming, particularly Sunday to Tuesday at 7:30. He said that's their real problem area, and that's what they need to turn around first.
Well, he's right. He's right.
Next, Nine CEO Hugh Marks faces the ire of his journos. So, finally, Hugh Marks messed up. Had to happen sooner or later. This week, he found himself on the wrong end of the questions from his journos after it emerged that a $10,000 per ticket fundraising event had been held not just at Nine's Willoughby offices, but on the set of the Today Show. Viv, how?
That sounds like a question for Hugh Marks. Look, it was inevitable that Hugh's incredible run of positive stories had to come to an end. You know, they had the better financial results of any media company so far. The merger with Fairfax has had some criticism, but largely has been seen as a success story. He hasn't had a Tim Warner level scandal, the former Seven CEO. He hasn't had the ratings battle and the financial woes that Channel 10 have had. So he's done all right, but he's decided to come quite unstuck in quite a public and political way. And I guess it's the first real teething problem that we've seen of that culture clash that everybody said was going to happen when Nine, this big entertainment behemoth, bought the allegedly left-leaning Fairfax newspapers. And that's definitely the narrative that's playing out now, big corporate evil Nine and its political buddies versus these poor Fairfax journos who just want to tell the truth without fear or favour.
But doesn't it show that they could? I mean, it was Fairfax who broke the story of what was going on, so they're obviously not under the thumb where they can't write anything negative about the company.
This is obviously the counterpoint that many people have raised, that, well, look, you know, this broke in the AFR and the Sydney Morning Herald, and those journos have been very critical, and they have been able to put out a statement via the union and run it and criticise it and hold Hugh to account. So in a way, yes, if he had tried to quash that coverage, then we would have been in a much more difficult situation. But I think people do feel like the journos, I think they're worried about what might happen next if Nine and Hugh are so cozy with the Liberal Party.
I wonder also, it's just a stick for the critics of Fairfax to beat them with now in the future, the Fairfax newspapers, the critics of Nine, is any time someone doesn't like any coverage which they perceive to favour the right, they'll point towards that example.
Yeah, it's not a great look. It wasn't a smart move from a PR point of view. And, you know, they've been saying that, well, we wanted to get in there to talk press freedom. And look, there's no doubt you want access to a prime minister. That, you know, that gives you leverage. You can have a conversation that you might not be able to have with them. But it wasn't a smart move. And the fact that Marx has come out and said it wasn't smart, we regret it, I actually think is very smart from him.
And look, he has said it's really important to lobby politicians and to have their ear. And, you know, the fact is Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister, is the Prime Minister at the moment.
Well, and you say he has said it. I mean, that's been slightly weird as well, because he's sort of, rather than put out a statement or anything, it was a note from James Chessel from the organisation to his journalist saying, Hugh's told me this.
Yes.
So it's which I think is because he's doing a roadshow overseas at the moment of investors. But it's a bit odd there's not been a direct statement.
Should there be, though?
Yes.
Isn't that a smart way of handling it, where it's not an official statement from Hugh, but the word gets out there?
Yeah, but all it's going to mean is everyone's going to be itching to ask Hugh about it at some point.
He's going to have to talk about it.
It's going
to
happen.
The first person that gets him on the phone is going to say, but hey.
That would have happened anyway.
But I think a lot of the issue comes back to that perception of money and power and that $10,000 per ticket. So in January, I was at the Australian Open courtesy of Nine, and I saw Hugh Marks go and sit next to Prime Minister Scott Morrison, and they were very chummy and very chatty. Nobody got up in arms about that, and, you know, they kept putting him on the screen, and Scott Morrison was very deliberately sipping his beer and being like, look, I'm a laid-back dude, just sipping a beer at the tennis. But he'd only sip it when he was on the screen. But nobody got upset about that because you could tell that Hugh was working the room or working the tennis court. It was relaxed. It was fine. I think this is more problematic just because of the money involved.
Oh, it's problematic for sure. But I come back to it. We wouldn't know about this story unless the AFR had reported on it, which is Nine's own paper. So I think that to me is proof positive that Nine are not controlling what they print, and it is still independent. And that's the perfect example.
So here's another question. It emerged in, I think, the Australian afterwards on Thursday morning, that there had been another fundraiser on the set of The Voice a few months before the takeover of Fairfax. If that had emerged at the time, do you reckon it could have scuppered the takeover? Like, would the Fairfax journos have been so up in arms? It would have.
I don't think the Fairfax journos would have had the power to stop that anyway. I'm sure it would have gotten headlines and given the Australian you know, some more ammunition, they would have been frothing. I mean, as they said, they called the Fairfax, former Fairfax journos, feral in their coverage of this, that the journos have gone feral. It would have given them another angle, another reason to slam their competitors, but I don't think it is big enough to have scuppered the whole deal.
Next, are we in a media recession? So this week we saw redundancies announced, or possibly announced is the wrong word. Perhaps it's emerged from both REA Group and the Foxtel sales arm MCN, Multi-Channel Network. Although rumour has it they're about to change their name. And while both companies were quick to say that the redundancies were as a result of changing structures and that staff would be moved into other roles where possible, it does feel like there's a little bit of doom and gloom about the state of the industry at the moment. Viv, your call first. Are we in a media recession?
Well, as someone who's coming up for 3 years in the role, something I can say confidently is that the industry is smaller now in late 2019 than it was when I started in December 2016.
As someone who's been 30 years in the role, I can also say that. I think we've just said that every single year.
All right, story topper. There are less people. There's been redundancies. There's been restructures across creative agencies, media owners, just across the board. It's really ramping up at the moment. And look, we're always writing redundancy and restructure stories at the moment. There are less jobs for people to go to, whether you're junior, mid-level, or an executive. So I'm not an economist. I don't know when we cross the line to be in a recession, but
2 quarters of negative growth.
So are you calling it, Tim?
Yes.
We are.
Yes.
Yeah, look, there's definitely not as many jobs going. It's definitely not a time to be job hunting in this area. And it does feel like even companies which have done okay are now starting to have to do the restructure and do the redundancies.
Rob, does it feel chilly to you?
Look, it does. And I think you see that with some of the results that are happening. You know, Seven's result is a really interesting game changer as far as what's going to happen. I am still glad to hear that Warburton's going to spend money, though. Can I ask about MCN, though? Weren't they always destined to have redundancies after 10 took their sales arm back?
Well, they sort of had one round already, didn't they?
Yeah, so I think the difference here is that the breakup with 10 happened quite a while ago now. So is this something else? And I suspect this something else is it's even further integration with Foxtel, because it is now the sales house for Foxtel. It's not.
In which case, it might as well be the sales house for News Corp. Why are there two sales houses?
Well, there's a game changer. That's interesting.
Well, perhaps that's what they're announcing. So, you know, in the coming weeks, they are announcing, you know, the future of MCN and what that looks like.
There's an event in our diary for Tuesday night.
We are hearing a lot about increasing collaboration between Foxtel and News Corp. Indeed, some Fox Sports programming has now moved into the News Corp studio on Holt Street.
Well, it had to, because that was doing nothing.
The redundant Your Money joint venture between Nine and News Corp. So we are seeing a lot more synergies there and all of those buzzwords and phrases that we use around redundancies and restructures.
Just remember, you heard it on Mumbrella. They won't say it, so I will. You heard it on Mumbrella first.
So look, for MCN, that they are having to reorientate for the future, and it's not really a surprise that they've lost more jobs. I think the scale of the REA ones was more shocking for people. So 60 redundancies. REA contended to me that's not a story. 60 isn't a story. It's not. We're a huge organisation. It's not big enough for you to report on. And when it's 60 and only and then 15 people are being redeployed, 60 is a lot of people to be out of jobs.
That's PR BS. Like, sorry, that's not even spin. That's just BS.
So it is huge. They say it's part of Owen Wilson, who, by the way, greatest CEO name in media land, it's part of his plan to reorientate the group and make it more digital, make it more technology focused and get it ready for the future in the face of a property downturn as well. But, you know, 60 is a story and, you know, it's a lot of people.
Next, taxi for Thinkabell. And finally for topics, 13 Cabs have released a new campaign, positioning itself as the official partner of everything from booty calls to Saturday mornings and from killer heels to bromances. Let's hear a clip.
Hey.
Hey, hon.
I just dropped the kids at mum's house. Yeah.
I gotta go.
Where are you going?
Something's come up.
Viv, how'd you like that campaign from Thinkabell?
Look,
let's start with booty calls, shall we?
So first up, it should be noted that I have an inherent bias against taxis, and I think a lot of people know that. So I don't like them. I've had some terrible experience in a taxi from a taxi driver. So it was going to be difficult to win me over with this campaign, particularly if you're focusing on women in heels, anything to do with alcohol and anything to do with sex in terms of booty calls and whatever. So they had a tough job to win me over. They didn't do it.
Now let's describe the booty calls ad, because it's a bit hard to play the clip of that one because it's mainly visual rather than audio. Now there's a gentleman on there that you know, you'll have to help me out with the terminology, but I believe they're portraying him as a fuck boy.
I mean, I just love that you've said that. I can't wait to use this audio again and again and again. Look, there is a shirtless man in bed in the dark sending a text message to his booty call, very effortless, very 2019. And, you know, it would appear that then the woman comes running, because why wouldn't you? A man's asked you over.
But isn't that reversed as well? Aren't there men running to the women look, doing booty calls?
There are. I don't like – I think you're right, Tim. I think it is a bit of a fuckboy thing. I would contend that taxis aren't the official partner of booty calls. I actually think people engaging in that would be far more likely to jump in an Uber than a taxi, or than to call 13 cabs to get to said fuckboy's house.
You could take that campaign and put it on Uber or anything like that. It's not a unique campaign to the company. It's not a unique selling point to the company. I have to say, it actually made me laugh, and I didn't offend me. You know, like I feel like I've become the Mary Whitehouse of Australia at the moment. I'm keep going on about the swearing on television and how kids can't watch it. But if my kids saw those commercials, I wouldn't be that offended. You know, like it's not overt, and it's not to me in your face and gratuitous. It was just a funny, you know, booty call. It just seemed a bit funny. You either like it or you don't.
Yeah, look, to me, I don't think it's offensive. I don't think it's crossing any lines. I just don't think it's very good. I just didn't enjoy it. There's another one where it's the official partner of Killer Heels. And it has a woman, you know, dressed up to go out and struggling with her heels while her friends impatiently wait for her in the car. Oh, I don't know. I just think it's relying on stereotypes, really. The drunk boys getting into the cab for the bromance one.
These guys are marketing people. So let me ask you, there seems to be a fight against stereotypes. Don't stereotypes exist for a reason, and aren't they good as a shortcut to sell a story?
Correct. I think they are, but I think there are stereotypes that work, and then there are ones that I think are lazy. So stereotypes exist for a reason, because you observe human behavior and you can find patterns if you're looking for them, and you can exploit them and use them so that people feel connected to an idea and can identify with a person on screen. I think you can do that without being lazy. And I think that's the issue here. Sure, more women wear heels than men, so obviously it's going to work to have women in heels, not men, and things like that. But I just think it's relying on lazy stereotypes.
You could have done that with a drag queen. That would have been funny.
You could have. But look, as I said, I'm not a fan of the campaign, but maybe you are, Tim.
Look, it didn't say much to me about my life.
Well, are you sure? Because there's one that features, and forgive me here, Tim, there is one that features a middle-aged man who is
a slightly overweight middle-aged man.
I didn't say that. I said
I do not wear lycra. Oh, that's the main difference.
Who is contemplating going for a bike ride, and then due to the discomfort of the lycra as he unpicks his wedgie, he decides not to go for a bike ride and
decides, go for a taxi ride.
That is the most bizarre ad for all of them for me, because it seems like he's going to be the mammal, the middle-aged man in Lycra, to go for a ride, and then decides...
I've never heard that.
Then decides not to, so gets a cab. So, Tim, is that the guys jumping for a Saturday morning cab ride instead? I don't get the logic there. Oh, I can't be bothered to go for my cycle with my mates to get a latte, so I'll jump in a cab and drive around the block? What is that ad?
I think that's unanswerable. And I also think that's pretty much the end of the Mumbrella cast. Do listen to TV Black Box. It's a great podcast. I listen to it every single week.
Thank you.
Do listen to McKnight Tonight, which you don't seem to do quite as often as
No, that's sporadic. And it's a case of I have some already recorded that I haven't been able to get out. So in the next few weeks, I will have Ash Williams and Catherine Kelly Lang, who I just recorded today. And I'll work on getting some more. People are saying to me more McKnight Tonights, which is great. I think they just like the jingle. out of anything, but thank you for your kindness, and I genuinely mean it. I love the Mumbrella podcast. As soon as it comes up, I listen to it, and I was going this week, where's the Mumbrella podcast? And then I went, oh yeah, it can't be happening yet. I'm recording it.
I'm the star.
Well, no, I'm not the star. I'm just the guy who won't shut up.
Well, that is it for this week. Thank you, Rob, and thank you, Vivian.
Thanks.
Toodle-pip.